begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Season's greetings. You're listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your lead caroler, Lady P, no relation to Master P. And joining me in the holiday revelry is one acquaintance that shall never be forgot. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Martin Kessler.
I'm a warped, frustrated young man. Hello.
Yes, you are, Martin. Also making his annual appearance on the show is my brother, jolly old St. Gary Lampert.
That's right. That's right.
Gary has a very special delivery for you, dear listener. You probably have gathered that it's a Christmas-themed episode. But, Gary, what delightful treat have you brought us? And is there a pear tree involved?
I'm going to be pitching It's Wonderful Life for the FlixWise favorites list.
Wonderful. All right, Gareth, then why don't you go ahead and tell us. Take it away and tell us why you think Frank Capra's 1946 holiday classic is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. It's so nice to be here among family and friends during the holiday season. This time of year is very much a time to absorb one's surroundings and be grateful for all that we have. I know that when not reflective, I certainly can fall into the trap of taking things for granted and not appreciating my wonderful life. However, I can take solace in knowing that I'm not alone. For example, I noticed that our dear, curmudgeonly, warped, frustrated old men at Sight and Sound have neglected to note the cinematic triumph, It's a Wonderful Life. I'm not mad. I can understand the oversight. The modal voter must think. Unmatched Jimmy Stewart acting. Classic comedy scenes. The most touching story ever. Yeah, but check out the deep focus and mise-en-scene from Renoir.
Ooh, shots fired. Look at that.
I get the sentiment. But they, like me, might be taking a cinematic masterpiece for granted. Everyone should be familiar with the story. Building and loan banker George Bailey gives up all his life dreams for others, and after some unfortunate events lead to gloomy prospects, he is now about to take his own life. An angel intervenes, and he sees the world as if he never existed. The images in the story have been repeated so often that they've become cliché. However, without proper meditation, we often forget what a triumph the movie is. No movie is as fundamentally affecting. No movie is as universally understandable. And in my opinion, no performance is as better than Stewart's. For these reasons, it should be on the damn list.
Ah, all right. Well, tell us what you really think, Care. That was... You delivered some harsh truths.
Yeah.
But somebody needed to say it. All right, well, Martin, do you agree that... I hardly know where to begin. There were so many superlatives just thrown at me at once. But universally relatable was one, right? Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Stewart, greatest performance ever as George Bailey. Are you inclined to agree?
Yeah, I kind of am. I didn't think I was going into this film, but I think I liked it a lot more than I expected. I mean, as far as Capra goes, I think It Happened One Night is still more kind of my thing, but this really won me over. I think, Stewart's performance is really fantastic, actually. It's sort of tempting to caricature, mm-hmm. but I think it's pretty nuanced, actually, when you see the character internalizing a lot of the frustrations in his life. And even though it ends up being a very, like, positive film, I think maybe he's kind of a tragic character, and it kind of leads into, like, the Hitchcock Stewart films where he's playing, like, perverts and peeping toms and sort of more flawed characters. mm-hmm. But this is sort of, like, the nice midpoint between, the idealistic Stewart and the later Stewart. So I think, like, exactly. This might actually be one of, if not his best performances.
Yeah. He has this reputation as America's good old boy. There's this sort of aw shucks niceness to him. At least that's what people perceive, but that really only goes for his very early performances. And here we see how he transitioned into a much, much darker character. And I kind of want to dispel the notion of him as this kind of America's sweetheart or whatever the male version of that is, because that I feel like that really minimizes what he's doing. He's a tremendous actor, and he had a tremendous amount of range. And we really see that on display here, where he's asked to go from basically late adolescence into a middle-aged man, and each part of that journey, he plays that role convincingly. And we watch as he becomes slowly embittered while still remaining sort of upright and just overall decent person.
I think he is a decent person. And I don't want to, there's nothing wrong with him being, good old boy implies Southern, but nothing wrong with that reputation for he has for the aw shucks nice guy. You know, I love his performance in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I love his performance in You Can't Take It With You. But though Jimmy Stewart is not, his affectations are not like anyone I know, his performance, the kind of emotions he portrayed, are applicable to anyone. It's, you could put anyone in his shoes, even though his character is better than most people.
Yeah, I guess the persona is kind of this everyman kind of thing. But what I sort of bristle at is the idea that there aren't shades to that character, and that he's always Jimmy Stewart. And I must admit, like in the past, I have written Jimmy Stewart off as this sort of, as that persona. But when you watch his films, there's clearly, he does so much more emoting, and he doesn't rely on that affectation in the way that some other notable actors of the time do. I'm looking at you, Cary Grant. but don't get me wrong. I love Cary Grant. But I think that there's just so much more nuance in a Jimmy Stewart performance.
Well, like, I was just thinking, like, about the idea that this is, like, this character is better than the average person. And I was sort of wondering at times, like, if this film were remade today, if we would see him as more of a pushover, like he's sort of doing the, you know, good thing, but it always seems to come at the expense of like his own personal satisfaction. And he keeps sort of giving into this, you know, what's the right thing to do and not always what he wants. And it seems to really make him frustrated with where he is in his life. Like my favorite scene from a dramatic point of view in the film was when he kind of snaps at his family, and because of, like, I thought that felt like a really real moment. You know, I think people like that often do have this sort of snapping point where they feel like they're doing everything right and good, and they're not necessarily rewarded for that, or not necessarily any happier in the long run. So I that really kind of impressed me about this character. It wasn't just I think like a caricature of a good person. I think there was a lot of maybe darkness to him. I could buy why he was standing over the bridge ready to jump off.
Yeah, his crisis felt very relatable and real. But he also, yes, he's a good person, but he has a bit of a martyr complex. Like those around him encourage him to go out and see the world and do what he wants, but he doesn't. He actively chooses to stay time and time again.
I mean, it kind of reminded me of, in a really roundabout way, of Tommy Wiseau's The Room, which I know like people consider the opposite of a good movie, but like that's a very kind of warped, honest depiction of this like martyr fantasy where, you know, you're such a good, selfless person and then like everyone would miss you so much when you're gone. I think like in a way it is sort of a fantasy to think that you're really making a difference in the world by compromising your own satisfaction. And I think like again, the cynical part of me would be a little bit like, I don't totally buy what happens in the ending. Like it's very much a fantasy, but I think like within the world that Capra creates, I go along with it.
Well, I think the message itself is a worthwhile message that, you know, everyone touches everyone's life. He happens to touch it in very dramatic ways where he actually saves people's lives. Yeah. So the consequences of his absence are more obvious than for others.
Right. I think we should, let's talk about the message, because it does, there are many. There's not one message in this movie, which is kind of why I like it. It's become a perennial Christmas classic, but it was never intended as such. It was just it was a movie that Frank Capra made post-war, and it seems to me more about getting perspective. But it's also it's about in part about a subject that I grapple with all the time, and I think most people, most decent human beings do, which is, what does it mean to be a good person? And in this case, doing good is its own reward. And as that as trite as that may sound, it is something that it helps to come to terms with, and it helps to be reminded. But that is kind of sentimental pap, whatever. But it's one, it's true. It has to be true. Two, we all go through a similar crisis as George at some point in our lives, because being an adult is about compromise. And that's what he does. We aren't perhaps quite as self-sacrificing as George, but he gets stuff out of it anyway. And like our idealistic notions that we have as teenagers, generally speaking, we don't stick to them throughout the course of our lives. We all come to terms with responsibility. We all face the same issues that George faces, financial troubles, familial obligations, etc. So that probably less than the actual Christmas part or the actual fantasy part was what really struck me when I rewatched it for this podcast, is that you could cut away the last 20 minutes of the movie and it would be just as powerful.
I agree with that. Someone who had not never watched it before, which those people, I guess, are more rare nowadays. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to give the impression it's not a sad movie.
No.
Most of it's comedy. It's typical Capra comedy. You would see in It Happened One Night, or You Can't Take It With You. It's these a lot of funny scenes, a lot of banter. And it's kind of punctuated with this melancholy in every scene where he gives everything up. But I don't want to fall into the temptation where we have to reward this movie only if it's not completely positive. Mm-hmm. Like, if it doesn't have a uniquely positive message. I think what you're getting after is the first, two-thirds of the movie, they do have this melancholy, and he's not a perfect person. You kind of relate in your own life how we all sort of abandon our dreams along the way. And I think that serves a purpose. It would be a much worse movie without that ending, not only because you lose the emotional payoff, but because the message there is, that this is okay. And this is what I appreciate about the movie is that it has a very clear, it has many messages. But as I get older, I appreciate less. Nuance can be good, but if you can communicate a point clearly, that's something special. So they have a story, and the message of the movie, if we take the main message, which is written on the card by Clarence, they have communicated it very clearly. You understand exactly what that means, mm-hmm. and why it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too often we reward movies where, the ending's ambiguous, what's the lesson we're going to take here?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie's an achievement in that, in its clarity.
Okay.
I was thinking, Ayn Rand must have hated this film if she saw it, because I think it equates altruism with goodness in a very sort of strong way. Like there's, to be good is to be selfless, I think, within this film. And there are times when I sort of think, maybe not to get too personal, but I think a good person should maybe stand up for themselves a little bit more often. There's times where you don't want to live in the dilapidated mansion. Maybe you should say something,
Or
there were times where I wasn't totally on board with that idea, but I think it follows through with such a strength of expression that I think even though it's expressing something I might not 100% agree with, I think it expresses it so well that it wins me over.
Is it a modern idea that self-sacrifice isn't necessarily noble?
Well, we're much more entitled, I think, now that, yeah. I mean, really coming out of like post-war America, I think like there's been more of a trend to entitlement, and it's, I think like that probably makes this film, maybe to some people anyway, feel a little bit antiquated, I guess, or at odds with maybe a current set of values. You rarely see, I guess, this set of morals explored nowadays. I think we're sort of so cynical that the idea of goodness as its own reward is seen as somehow dumb. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's not like Harry's not a villain in the movie. We're okay with Harry, and Harry actually does the big things. He becomes the engineer. He is a war hero.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's not anti those other things. It's very sentimental. It's everyone's a hero in their own way.
Yes,
I mean,
indeed.
He did things that were great, but they're very on a very small scale. But that's what's important, because it was what Bedford Falls needed. Unless you like Pottersville.
Which Pottersville has its own contingent of fans, believe you me. It looks like a lot more fun. Not that Bells of St. Mary's isn't a great movie. Did you notice that Bells of St. Mary's is what's playing on the Bedford Falls marquee? This is a happening place. Let's talk about Pottersville versus Bedford Falls. Now, Gary, I think you'll agree that this film is unabashedly populist. Its message seems very, very leftist.
You think so?
I think so. It's very anti-corporate, anti-big bank, right? So my question to you, Gary, is why, on this holiest week of the year, did you feel the need to submit this pinko commie Marxist propaganda?
I've never heard it characterized. I have heard a number of years back, Glenn Beck held up this film as an example of the American ideal.
Wow.
So, you know, he's going to be, it's the bank examiner that's going to be taking him to jail, just showing those regulations run amok, picking on the little guy.
Oh, boy.
I think the real villain of this film is Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
There are so much. I mean, we could list off all the things, as with any movie that's made a long time ago, we could list off the things that you kind of are taken aback. So his enthusiasm for lending money for mortgages without thorough underwriting, perhaps in light of the recent crisis, we might think is less than ideal.
Yeah, maybe a little irresponsible.
Perhaps, you know, Mr. Potter may have a prudent point. But, you know, there was a time where bankers, you would have more of a relationship with a local banker, and they would make you a loan partially because they actually knew you. So that harkens back to an old time. Mm-hmm. Should be noted also that Stewart and Capper were both Republicans. Do this analysis.
But Republicans mean something very different now. For Capra, it's hard to argue that Capra wasn't a populist. He made populist films.
Well, it's also hard to argue like Donald Trump's not a populist. So,
but he was a populist in an economic sense. Like, he was clearly in favor of housing for everyone and like anti-big business. Like,
yeah,
that's the.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know if so. It's hard to imagine.
Podcast.
I know. What is happening? This is what happens every time Gary and I talk.
Oh, yeah. I just find it hard to imagine anyone would watch the movie and change their views on, anything. Political.
Well, do you think, like, I mean, you characterize this as populist, but, like, I think it wasn't a success when it was first released, and I think it, like, really hurt Capra's career. Do you think, I don't know why it wasn't successful. Do you think there's a specific reason for that? Does it have to do with depictions in the movie, or some other circumstance.
Some have said it was marketed poorly, like it was marketed as a romance.
I'm not sure how you would market this film.
Yeah, that's true. How? I mean, I guess Christmas movie. It's brilliant. It was staring them right in the face. But it was marketed as a romance. And while it is a very romantic movie in many ways, mostly because Donna Reed is so fantastic. But that being said, I think if you walk into this movie expecting a romance, you will be sorely disappointed.
I think it's romantic.
It is romantic.
I think some of the advertisements had sort of emphasized, I don't know how many advertisements did this, but I've at least seen posters where it emphasized sort of a love triangle between George, Mary, and Violet.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they were thinking there.
Yeah. It does seem like Violet is more of a marketing ploy. She doesn't have very much to do in the movie.
Well, she has a role within the town.
Yeah.
I like her line, this whole thing, I only wear it when I don't care how I look.
That, it should be noted, is Gloria Graham, noted femme fatale, film noir. If this were film noir, we'd know to look out for her.
I mean, this is kind of like, it almost feels like the opposite of a film noir. It's... I mean, there are dark things going on in it, but it's like the opposite sort of approach. It's interesting.
The Pottersville is kind of a film noir.
Yeah.
That scene is...
Yeah, I guess when he's on the run from the cops, yeah.
20 minutes of this movie is a film noir. We got some genre hopping. We got romance, we got Christmas movie, we got film noir.
There's so many of these elements, and it's got kind of a weird structure, but like... I think it really works well, actually. Like, there's the love... subplot. There's so many subplots, story threads that are just like laid out throughout that first chunk, and then they wrap together so well in that final 20 minutes, I guess. Even though it seems like this movie should be all over the place, it doesn't really feel that way.
Yeah, how did he thread that needle? It's kind of amazing. It starts off in heaven, first of all.
Utter space heaven.
Yeah. And somehow we're transported to this tiny town, and we get we get his life in this, you know, it's told, the ellipses are told so that they're invisible. We don't even notice. And then we get this crazy supernatural part at the end. It's remarkable in that the structure is unique. And yet it is so easy. It is so comprehensible.
Yeah. I think if it did not work in this sort of flashback mode, you could not have the supernatural element. It's because it's introduced right at the beginning that this is, you know, it's like they're watching the same movie we are.
Mm.
That it all works and seems less gimmicky. I don't know. It could be audiences at the time. Though I think it got generally good reviews. They may have been taken aback by sort of a gimmicky approach to it.
Mm.
But I think it's effective. I think Capra has explicitly said he wanted this also to be a pro-religion film.
Mm.
You know, getting back to your populist thing, it's populist, maybe anti-Big Bang, but also pro-small towns, pro-family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I love that it is this perfect amalgam of... spirituality with humanism. So there's really kind of something for everybody, because faith plays a part in the movie, and it's stated explicitly, and there are actual angels. There are literal angels in this movie. But at the same time, it is humanism that saves George Bailey. It is the goodness of people that saves George Bailey.
Yeah, it's... like, I think it's sort of a universal spiritual awakening that happens in the film, which I think helps make it feel like it's not too Christian specific. It reminded me a lot of Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and how the supernatural is kind of this like framing device, and it's another Christmas story, mm-hmm. which takes a melancholy route to get to this feel good ending. I mean, it's not secular, but it doesn't take, I think, the Christian values too seriously. Like in this, there's jokes about Mark Twain writing new novels up in heaven and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's,
yeah.
I think it's pretty accessible.
Yeah. anyway, I did want to talk a little bit about Mary, because watching it this time, Donna Reed's performance really struck me. As wonderful as Jimmy Stewart is, and he is so, so wonderful, and he has so much heavy lifting to do, I love the way that Mary is portrayed, in that she's not a martyr. She's getting exactly what she wants, and she doesn't do it in a manipulative way. She says exactly what she wants. It doesn't feel like she's sacrificing anything. I mean, as whiny as George gets, and let's be real, he gets whiny. What really makes him rich is that he found the most perfect wife ever, most perfect, most understanding wife ever. And yet Donna Reed doesn't play her as this saintly figure, just someone with the patience of a saint. But does that character strike you as kind of unrealistic, or what was your reaction to Mary?
I mean, the only thing that struck me as unrealistic is her being a spinster in the alternate
fantasy. My God.
Oh, no, Mary, you're single and you live with books.
And you have glasses. Oh, hideous.
I think you're right. Like, I think what's kind of nice about her character is she's sort of more active, like, because George is somebody who's sort of always kind of going along, doing the right thing. It's kind of nice to have a character who just sort of says, I want this, and goes through with it. You know, mm-hmm. I will love him. I want the mansion I want. And she's not afraid to go after it. I think it's sort of a nice contrast or foil, actually, to George's personality.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I should also say, so if you read too much, it strains your eyes. So that could explain the glasses.
That's true, yeah.
Well, that's how they know you're smart.
Yeah.
Poor Mary got all smart.
Somebody should just put her out of her misery.
No. But, yeah, I think, Martin, I think you hit the nail on the head. She's the perfect foil for George, and sort of it's the contrast between, like, the nobility of self-sacrifice versus the also noble pursuit of going after what you want. It is not evil to go after what you want, and this movie also demonstrates that.
That's cool. And I don't think the movie ever looks down upon that in pursuing your dreams. She, the movie's about George, mm-hmm. and she's there because you need someone a little more flat. So the only two that you really get to know, or you have conversations with them other than George, and you get to know what their feeling is, his dad mm-hmm. and Mary.
Mm-hmm.
And she's there because you need sort of genuine relationships to understand. So if the movie was made now, they could probably do the Mary alternate reality better, obviously. but I mean, what they're getting after is, you know, she loved him. He was there for that. And that was something really important. And this just, you know, if you buy into it, which, you know, you have to go in the right mindset, it's still powerful. You know, they never had what they had if he wasn't around.
Mm-hmm.
And she strengthens this because of their sort of contrasting personalities.
Right.
But I think it's just, I think that's true, but it's also notable in that she bolsters George, but she is also a fully realized character. And that is notable because that is not always the case, even in movies that come out in 2015. I'm looking at you, Bridge of Spies. Anyway.
sorry to jump in, but it's kind of funny that, like, Spielberg is compared a lot to Capra. And, like, mm-hmm. I think maybe some of his films were very Capra-like, Capra-esque.
Yes.
But, like, I don't know. I'm a little bit bummed out by Steven Spielberg's films lately. I think it's become, mm-hmm. I don't know what. But I think, like, you can see why Spielberg's films were so popular and why Capra's films were so popular. I think they're kind of appealing to the same sensibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Tom Hanks, star of Bridge of Spies, is often compared to Jimmy Stewart. Fair or not, I'm honestly not super sure where that comparison comes from. I guess they're both universally likable.
Like, Jimmy Stewart, like, usually... Well, like, eventually he went on to play characters that I think were typically darker than the kinds of characters that Tom Hanks played. Like, it's hard to imagine Tom Hanks in something like Vertigo.
Yeah. It always blows my mind. Like, Jimmy Stewart's best performance... I don't know. I don't want to say best. But one of his best performances is in Vertigo, where he is... he's unhinged. He's not a good dude. He's not a nice man.
No, I think if Tom Hanks be like in Road to Perdition or something. You just want to give him a hug, like.
Yeah, yeah. But he fully embodies someone who is basically, I don't know, I mean, psycho is the wrong word because that's a different movie, but but someone who is mentally unstable and certainly not an aw shucks nice man, a manipulative man, and like he plays it with steely reserve. Like, it's not, there's nothing precious about that performance. So I really
Like the murderers in Rope, when they're talking to Jimmy Stewart, like, oh, we thought you would understand why we would murder somebody for fun. Like, yeah. You're the guy we would trust with this.
that's true. Yeah, exactly. I guess that speaks to the power of this movie and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where that persona and of that movie, so much of his persona or people's ideas of his persona comes from his Capra performances. And because of that, he will forever be the everyman, the upstanding Mr. Boy Scout. I do not mean to speak ill of Tom Hanks. I'm just saying he's not Jimmy Stewart.
No.
Let's get rid of it. I do not think that's accurate at all.
I don't think we have a Jimmy Stewart today, really.
I would say, I think, yeah, I've actually heard you make this point before. If you look at Jimmy Stewart's acting style, it's pretty modern.
Yeah.
I mean, he's, you know, it's not like Heston or something where it's, you know, it's kind of a mismatch from, or a different era. He'd fit in today with, you know, who are some of the real internal method, I don't know, what's his name? The one who everyone loves.
Daniel Day-Lewis. I think he's much better than Daniel Day-Lewis.
All right, but that same, you know, really absorbing the whole... I mean, when he's... So the most powerful scene in It's a Wonderful Life, in my mind... Well, it changes from each time I see it. But the one that always pretty much... When he's in martinis, and he's realizing the world's just come crashing in on him, he's so absorbed into the character that it would fit in at any era.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. It's a truly timeless...
I think that's why his career went on longer than some of his contemporaries from the like 1930s and 40s films. Like, you know, he was acting all the way into the 60s, and I think a lot of those performances feel strong compared to some of the other people who kind of disappeared by then.
Right, yeah. I think part of the reason he is so good is that he wasn't afraid to be vulnerable, and... I certainly don't mean to crap on Cary Grant, because I love Cary Grant. Again, love Cary Grant or any of the other dashing leading men of that era. But, you know, famously in Gone with the Wind, Clark Gable was reticent to cry. Eventually he was talked into it, and the movie is more powerful for it. But that was the case with many leading men of that era. You would never see Gary Cooper cry. And as a result, I think, like, he doesn't have the range of Jimmy Stewart, and he could never pull off this movie. And there's, indeed, like, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington versus Meet John Doe, I think that Mr. Smith Goes to Washington is stronger because it has the emotionalism of Jimmy Stewart versus the stoicism of just about every other leading man. And as a result, like, they become more interchangeable. you know, obviously someone like Humphrey Bogart has a certain Humphrey Bogart quality. Like, you cannot, that's truly irreplaceable. But Jimmy Stewart, yeah, it's not so much the persona that makes him special. It is his vulnerability.
Yeah, he has range and he has a persona. Mm-hmm. So if we take a movie where they really, and I know you like this example, where they really take two personas and play them off each mm-hmm. other, be the man who shot Liberty right, Valance, right. where you got John Wayne and Jimmy yeah. Stewart. Yeah. And, you know, there's the Jimmy Stewart persona, and then there's who he actually mm-hmm. is.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. yeah. That, no, that's the perfect utilization of... Yep. Of on-screen personas.
That's such an interesting one to like just contrast both big personas like Wayne and Stewart. Like they're so different actually, but they both have these affectations.
Yeah, nailed yeah. it. All right. Well, Martin, one thing struck me as I was watching this movie.
I'm sorry.
And that struck. You get it? You know what I'm going with this? Bells. Yet another movie that ends in bells.
I think every time a bell rings, we have a conversation about existentialism.
I know. Exactly. Exactly. It's so true, Martin. What is happening? Is that just the key to making a good movie? It's either got to end at the beach or it ends in bells. In all seriousness, this movie, when I watched it this time, totally reminded me of Andrei Rublev. I'm just putting it out there.
I know.
I'm just saying, you Tarkovsky fans who are quick to dismiss Frank Capra as sentimental, I think that there are way more parallels than any cynical cinephile might be willing to admit.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of talk through the bell as a symbol a lot in Andrei Rublev and Sit and Tango, and we sort of touched on Breaking the Waves, but I think, like, because it is a powerful symbol and a religious symbol, I think that's maybe one reason why you see it coming up a lot in these films that are sort of derived from Christian morality or sort of deal with the religious themes.
Yeah. I guess I should clarify, I assume that our listeners would follow me along this course of where I'm going with this, but basically, you'll recall at the end of the movie, one of the final lines is, Zuzu says to Jimmy Stewart's character, she says, "Teacher says, every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings." And this is just after hearing a little bell sound. Now, on this show, we've talked about a number of different films that end in bells. This seems to be a thing. And in the past, we've said, in the case of Andrei Rublev, it symbolizes a return from despair, and like the bells ring out, and it symbolizes hope and a return to faith. Versus something like Satan Tango, where the bell is an empty symbol and it just symbolizes false hope. But in this movie, we are decidedly in the Andrei Rublev camp, or I should say, since this movie predates Andrei Rublev, that Andrei Rublev is firmly in the It's a Wonderful Life camp. And I want to know whether Andrei Tarkovsky watched this movie before he made Andrei Rublev.
I can't tell you how happy that is I what am I'd that like. Bellatar and Andrei Rublev can come up on a podcast where we talk about a
yes.
Jimmy Stewart Christmas movie.
Yes. Welcome to Flix Slice. It's absolutely so true. If this movie were in Russian, it would absolutely be on the Sight and Sound list. Right?
Yeah, probably. I think there would be a lot more candid angles and like eye lighting, but I'm sure you're right.
Yeah, well, I mean, that really, Andrei Rublev is an alternate Christmas movie. So once you've finished with this one, maybe if you have an extra 3 hours on your hands, maybe pop in some Andrei Rublev. Just putting it out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as we've learned, Satan Tango is great for New Year's, so you can follow it up with
absolutely.
That.
Oh my God, don't do that. Poor Tad. Yeah, listeners can, if you would like to understand the jokes we are making, please see our Andre Rublev episode and our Bellator Satan Tango episode. So, any final thoughts on It's a Wonderful Life before we put it to a vote? Martin?
Well, I read somewhere, I think it was crack.com of all places, a while ago, that they sort of said that maybe the reason why it was played on TV so much is because the film had slipped into public domain, so it was free to show. And I've seen it sort of repeated a lot of times since, that people kind of say, oh, it's only popular because it's a public domain film and it's been flogged a lot. And I just wanted to refute that really quick. I think, you know, people... I think, like, if this conversation hasn't already clued people in, there are a lot of films in the public domain. Not all of them are as good as this. So the fact that it's been shown on TV every year doesn't take away from the fact that it's a good movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if Holiday Inn is in the public domain, but there's a reason this gets shown every year at Christmas. And that one, generally, you have to go to TCM or whatever. But nothing against Holiday Inn. But
I think the public domain aspects, why, you know, so there are a lot of great old movies. This explains why a movie that was did only okay at the box office at the time was rediscovered, mm-hmm. and everyone got to see it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Though apparently only partially in the public domain, which is why NBC
it's got kind of a strange history. Yeah, I think, like, if it was shown on TV and nobody cared and nobody watched it, it wouldn't be shown again and again and again. I think, you know, that might have helped it be rediscovered and sort of opened up to a wider audience. But I think it's, you know, there shouldn't be any question that this is a fantastic film. It's also, it plays great on TV too. I think, like, it's sort of emotional in a, like, accessible way. And it's, I think it's the kind of film that you can jump into almost at any point and follow along, you know, and the episodic kind of structure of it lets you slip in commercials maybe. And it probably helped it quite a bit be seen, but, yeah, I don't think it's purely its inexpensiveness that's, had so many people watch it and rewatch it.
Exactly. Hey, I forgot to ask you this, Martin. When did you first see It's a Wonderful Life?
Like, probably technically, like, yesterday, but
okay.
I had seen, like, large chunks of it before. I had seen it sort of in bits and pieces, so I could kind of put it together in my head piecemeal. And, like, it's such a big part of popular culture that I kind of mm-hmm. knew what it was already. But I think this was the first time I had actually sort of sat down and watched it deliberately.
Yeah. Is it, what were your expectations going in, and what?
I think just because, like, you know, when you're seeing it in different places, I think, like, my expectations a while ago were that it was maybe going to be a little bit more sugar-coated. I didn't really, like, I knew what it was about, but I didn't expect it to really show why a person would want to kill themselves on Christmas.
Yeah, the power of the movie is in part in the catharsis. And as Gary and I have talked about a lot in the past, this movie takes you really low before bringing you really, really high. So you just feel so good afterwards. But and that in itself is an achievement. Is like there's this euphoria that comes with watching this movie. And it's different than any other movie that I can think of.
Yeah, I agree. And I'd also, you know, say, you know, being the one pitching this, but whenever we pitch these FlixWise favorites, we always, at least I feel, there's a slight burden, it's like taking it to those snobs, you know, so we're like killing them because they didn't include Clueless or Airplane. And there's something fundamentally wrong with their worldview. In this case, I'd like to say there's nothing wrong with their worldview and the types of movies. I'd say on the grounds that they judge those other movies, It's a Wonderful Life still holds up.
Okay.
It is a well-made film, well-acted. And, you know, on any list, given the current movies they have, probably some exceptions of some real downers, it would fit right in.
Okay.
Right. And it shouldn't just be viewed as a Christmas movie.
Yes. Yes, indeed. All right. Well, then, shall we put it to a vote? Martin, do you think Frank Capra's It's a Wonderful Life is worthy of the FlixWise favorites list?
Big yes.
Big yes. I'm going to say yes too, Gary. I assume you have not changed your mind in the last half hour or so?
40 minutes or so?
That's correct.
Okay, all right.
Then I hereby put It's a Wonderful Life in the FlixWise favorites list.
Yay.
Yay! Yay! I need a little sound drop for that. It's going to be something, some triumphant music. Oh my God! Yes! And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise, that is. Listeners, do you think It's a Wonderful Life is indeed wonderful? Come leave us a comment on our website, FlixWise.com. Let us know. And you can come join in our collective cheer on Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. Then come follow me over to Twitter. The handle is @FlixWise. But before you do all of that, my wish this Hanukkah season is that all of our listeners head over to iTunes and or Stitcher and rate us and leave us a comment. Tell the big folks at the podcatchers that we're doing a good job. I need no wrapped gifts, no Christmas cookies, no stuffed pheasants, just ratings, please. But also, if you happen to have a few extra cookies, I'll take those too. This is our last show of 2015. I just quickly want to relate my sincerest thanks to all of the listeners, whether you've recently discovered the show or you're a longtime listener. We so appreciate all the support and the lovely comments. It's been a wonderful adventure, and we hope to have many more in the coming years. Anyway, we'll be back in 2016, likely the second week of January. I'm actually going to be out of the country for a while, but when I get back, I'm going to try to pull together a year in review show, so stay tuned. In the meantime, Martin, thank you so much for being on this episode and just generally all that you do for the show. You've made yourself truly indispensable.
Well, thank you. That's thank you.
Yes.
I'm just going to, it's been an amazing pleasure being part of this. It's a wonderful part of my life. Now I'm going to run off to a Charleston competition.
What? Oh my God. No. Martin.
No, not at all.
I have to move to Toronto immediately.
We're going to dance in a swimming pool.
Oh my God. No. That would be so cool.
That would be horrible.
All right. And Gary, thank you so much for submitting It's a Wonderful Life for the favorites list.
Thank you for having me.
Always nice to have family around for the holidays. Okay, we're off to do collect on all of our do-gooding for the year. So maybe harass some neighbors with some carols. So until next year, happy holidays, everyone.
Should all acquaintance be forgotten? Acquaintance be forgot, and days of old lang syne.